ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Hello, I'm Tom Gilson. In August 2021, at the Center for Science and Culture Insiders Briefing in the greater Seattle area, biologist Ray Bolin got the chance to sit down with fellow biologist and Icons of Evolution author Jonathan Wells to discuss an exciting new development in the field of epigenetics and the light that discovery sheds on the evolution design debate. Happily, we were able to record it. Enjoy.
Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of the Discovery Institute and Intelligent Design. I'm your host today, Ray Bolin, and with me is Senior Fellow Dr. Jonathan Wells. So welcome, Jonathan.
Good to be here, Ray.
We're looking at here an article that came out online journal called Axios. And the first thing that they say here really caught my attention. It says that they've completed a new draft of the human genome sequence. And excuse me, but I thought they completed the human genome sequence 20 years ago in 2001. So why are they saying suddenly they've completed it?
Well, I can't read inside their minds, but the fact is that they have not done a complete version.
Oh.
Despite their claim. They've sequenced all the DNA in one set of chromosomes in one cell or one cell line.
Okay.
That did not include the Y chromosome, which is the male determining chromosome in humans.
That sounds a bit strange.
It's lacking. They did a good job. It's just that calling it complete is a bit of an exaggeration.
So it seems to me then you're saying that there is and will be variation from one human to the next, and they haven't really even begun to chart that yet.
That's right. That's called the Pangenome Project.
Okay. Okay.
And it's just barely getting started.
Okay.
Because your DNA is not the same as my DNA.
For the most part, it is.
Major parts of it are, yes.
Yeah. Okay. One of the things they report on next is saying that the human genome is comprised of 3.05 billion base pairs. And just to make sure everybody understands, I'm going to give a quick lesson here on DNA as exactly what a base pair is. So DNA is a double-stranded molecule, and there's a backbone of phosphate and sugar on each of those two strands, and then a base is attached to each of those sugar molecules. And those bases pair up with each other. An A always pairs with a T, and a G always pairs with a C. And so that, for instance, AT is a base pair. So the human genome has over 3 billion of those base pairs. Next, they go on to talk about, within this completed sequence, or actually not so complete sequence, that some of this non-coding DNA has been ignored for the past two decades, for 20 years. And when I heard that, I was reminded of what we're very familiar with, the ENCODE project, which is the Encyclopedia of DNA Elements, which refers to all of the human genome that's not coding for protein, not the genes. And I thought they've been doing that work since 2008, focusing a great deal on that with non-coding DNA.
Major papers published in 2012.
Okay. What would you say is the overall result of some of those early studies in particular?
Well, the studies done from 2000 to 2012 showed that the 98% or so of human DNA that does not code for protein is nevertheless transcribed into RNA.
Okay, so it's transcribed, but they didn't necessarily know what that RNA was doing.
That's right.
Okay.
It's been known since the 1970s that about 98% of our DNA is not translated into protein.
Okay.
The process, of course, is that the DNA is first transcribed into RNA.
Mm-hmm.
Then many RNAs are then translated into protein. But it turns out that while most of our DNA is transcribed into RNA, most of our RNA is not translated into protein.
Okay.
And so the part that was not translated into protein was called junk DNA.
Ah, yes.
Because back then they thought only the proteins mattered.
Yeah, and I remember when I was doing my doctoral work in the late 80s and early 90s, that term was around everywhere. And I remember thinking to myself, that just doesn't sound right. Why in the world would there be all this DNA with no use to it? So I had my doubts and never wrote anything about it, but I had my doubts for a long time.
Well, some biologists actually did write about it. Even when the term junk DNA first came out in the early 70s, some biologists objected that it was a mistake to label it junk and that much of it might indeed have function. Now, part of our problem today is, what do you mean by function?
Okay.
The ENCODE project found that most of our DNA, and possibly all, is transcribed into RNA. So it has a biochemical function of being transcribed. The bodily function of many of those RNAs, non-protein coding RNAs, remains unknown.
Okay.
So there's three, you could define function as being transcribed, which is how ENCODE does it.
Okay.
You could say that the transcripts, the RNA transcripts, actually affect something in the cell or the body. And that's normally done by biologists by knocking something out and showing that if you knock it out, the effect doesn't happen.
Okay.
And then there's a third kind of function, and that's the definition used by evolutionary biologists. For an evolutionary biologist, or for some of them anyway, function can be attributed to something only if it's not selected against.
Okay.
Okay, so they use selection as their criterion. Oh. The problem is you can't usually show that directly.
Yeah.
So an evolutionary biologist might compare different DNA segments or RNA segments and see if they're conserved.
Okay.
If they're conserved.
By conserved, that means what?
Similar sequences in different organisms.
Different organisms, okay.
Or different people.
Okay.
Individuals. The problem is we know that there are many sequences that are functional that are not conserved.
Okay.
So any estimate based on conservation has got to be an underestimate.
Sure.
So we have the underestimate from the evolutionary end and possibly an overestimate from the ENCODE end. And the truth is probably somewhere in between.
Okay.
I'm inclined to think it's closer to the ENCODE definition than the evolutionary definition.
Well, as I thought about that, if the cell is bothering to spend the energy to transcribe this DNA into RNA, why would it continue to do that if it didn't serve some sort of biological function?
I think that's a very good question, and I think that's a good reason to look for function.
Okay.
Furthermore, I think any time in biology, in science for that matter, if we look at something and we don't understand what it does, and we jump to the conclusion that it must be junk, is a very foolish conclusion.
Yeah.
If something's junk, you're not going to look for a function. And so for decades, as I think you indicated earlier, the so-called junk DNA was largely ignored.
Yeah.
Until ENCODE came along.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're finding out, I'd say every week a paper comes out in some science journal showing the function of some RNA that was previously thought to be junk.
Yeah. Okay. So now we're actually finding function to these RNAs.
We are. Functions in cancer, functions in embryo development, among other things.
Okay.
Resistance to disease.
We'll get to some of those here in just a little bit. I wanted to look at one of the things I mentioned in the Axios article is that these non-coding regions are regulating whether genes are on or off sometimes, or they alter their activity. So how could a non-coding RNA actually do that? Do we know?
Well, if by the gene's activity, we're talking about the protein that it encodes. There's several steps between the DNA and the protein.
Okay.
And those steps are affected by RNAs.
I see.
The whole process of translating an RNA into a protein is itself affected by other RNAs. And so it's known, actually, that some of these non-protein-coding RNAs help to regulate the protein coding function of some DNA segments.
Okay. So there's a lot going on in the overall architecture of how the DNA operates that we're still uncovering.
Oh, yes.
And apparently these non-coding RNAs are involved in a lot of that.
Yes.
Okay. Well, the article points out three areas that they're seeing that these non-coding RNAs have a role in. The first one is the course of cancer or even the effectiveness of treatment of cancer. In terms of cancer itself, they talk about some of these mutations in human patients in these non-coding RNAs are either increasing what they call oncogenes. What's an oncogene?
An oncogene is thought to increase the chances of a cancer.
Okay.
Uncontrolled cell division.
Uncontrolled cell division is what an oncogene essentially promotes.
Okay. Yes.
So some of these are increasing oncogene activity or just oncogenes in themselves?
I don't know the details.
Okay.
But there is certainly clear evidence that non-coding, non-protein coding RNA can affect cancer.
Okay. The other type of gene they look at are what are called tumor suppressive genes. Now, why would the human body have something like tumor suppressive genes in it?
Well, a tumor suppressor gene controls cell division.
Okay.
So you have a very good reason to want to control cell divisions in your body.
Okay, yeah.
If it gets out of control, you've got cancer.
Okay.
More than likely.
And some cell types will divide readily anyway, and some are very stable.
True.
Okay, so
some you want to divide.
Some you need to divide,
right.
Like those that are making all your blood cells.
That's right.
They have to keep producing and producing and producing. So there, an oncogene would be a regular part of that overall cell's function.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
It keeps dividing.
I'm not sure anyone would call it an oncogene. I'm not that familiar with the literature.
Well, let's just say maybe that tumor suppressor genes would be likely
inhibited.
Turned off or inhibited in those kinds of cell lines. And then you have things like your bone cells hardly divide at all. And so the tumor suppressor genes would be very active in those types of cells.
Presumably.
And if an oncogene gets going in a bone cell, that's trouble. So what they're saying is that these non-coding RNAs can have an effect in either increasing the oncogenes or decreasing the tumor suppressive genes.
Yes. RNAs that do not code for protein can nevertheless affect those cellular processes and many others.
Okay. Next, they talk about lemon head formation. And what I found fascinating here in particular was an item they mentioned here, severe congenital limb malformation may be caused by a long non-coding RNA being modified. So there are developmental genes in our genome that are controlling things like what's front, what's back, where a limb is put in place, where fingernails grow, where they don't grow, those kinds of things. What can you tell us about how could a non-coding RNA being modified change some of that?
First of all, I'm not sure I would say that genes control these things.
Okay.
They affect them.
They affect, all right.
They influence them. But there's a lot of things we don't know about spatial effects in development. Certain genes may do their work because they're in a particular spot.
Right, okay.
But they didn't put themselves in that spot.
Okay.
The spot was there first. But as I said before, RNAs do influence gene activity, that is, protein coding activity.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very delicate process. It has to be tuned just right to mm-hmm. make the results come out the way they should. And so if you mess up one of the non-protein coding RNAs in that chain of events, you can certainly affect the outcome.
Okay.
And that's been shown in certain specific cases.
Now, one of the cases they actually talked about in that article that was a link was contained in the Axios article, talked about knees actually being formed on the backside of the leg, and the legs actually bent the opposite direction. And then also in those same individuals, their fingernails would grow on the opposite side of the fingers than where they're supposed to grow. And that all was caused not by any mutation in the gene itself that was affecting that, but it was in the non-coding RNA that somehow got modified.
Mm-hmm.
That's just astounding to me that a non-coding RNA could have that kind of dramatic effect on.
So it's certainly a mistake to call it junk. Yeah. Maybe when
now it produces junk, but
if it's damaged, it can produce junk. But by itself, it's certainly not junk.
And perhaps last year, one of the things I talked about was a new therapy for sickle cell disease. And it's something very close to me. I have a good friend who's a pastor in Liberia, and his only daughter is affected with sickle cell disease. So red blood cells will sickle in certain situations. But what they're saying here is that there's been a discovery that somehow by actually being able to restart what they call fetal hemoglobin, that replaces the hemoglobin that's damaged because of the sickle cell disease. And that can be restarted with a non-coding RNA. So the fetal hemoglobin gene is still there. As fetuses, we use a different hemoglobin than after we're born, and that disappears and we have the normal hemoglobin. And that somehow that's able to be turned back on by a non-coding RNA.
Again, more evidence that it's not junk.
If you're to give us there's one more thing that was mentioned here about gene editing, and that has an effect on some of this. What did they mention about gene editing? What's the problem there with non-coding RNAs? First of all, what is gene editing?
Gene editing is actually changing the sequence of, usually gene refers to a protein coding segment of DNA.
Right.
But of course, you can change the sequence of a non-protein coding RNA. And in the last 10 years or so, they've gotten pretty sophisticated at targeting specific segments of DNA or RNA and chemically changing the sequence.
Yeah.
There's a lot of interest in this because of the possibilities, but there's also a lot of hurdles to overcome.
Now, they're using it in animal models, aren't they? Pretty extensively, gene editing.
Yes, in this day, I wouldn't be surprised if someone somewhere is using it on humans.
Oh, yeah. Well, we know it was done in China.
Yes. But the problem is, one problem, is that if you change a sequence of DNA or RNA, it can often does have, multiple effects. So the effect that you want, you might get, but chances are you're going to get other effects too.
Okay.
And those are not always effects that you want. So gene editing is a very challenging approach. And I'd say it's got a long way to go before I would trust it on human beings.
And they seem to indicate that the non-coding RNA, that could be affected by various gene editing techniques.
Oh, definitely.
Okay. Yeah. So if you alter a non-coding RNA, that could affect a gene elsewhere.
Yes.
In the genome.
Yes. There's so much we don't know about what goes on in the cell. Years ago, in 1980, I actually overheard a world-famous cell biologist say, not publicly, but privately to myself and a group of other students, we basically know all there is to know about a cell. We're just filling in the details.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, he couldn't have been more wrong. And I think that's still the case. A living cell is a very challenging area to explore. And anyone who thinks that they know everything there is to know about it is, you know the person's wrong even without hearing the end of the sentence.
Well, in conclusion, I think, first of all, you're telling us that this complete human genome sequence is not really all that complete yet.
Not yet.
Okay. And that these non-coding RNAs are playing a much larger role than anybody could have imagined even 30 years ago.
That's for sure.
Okay.
As I said, reports are coming out, I'd say weekly, in scientific journals of newly discovered functions for non-protein coding RNAs.
Well, thank you, Jonathan, for being with us today on ID the Future. And I am Ray Bolin, your host, and this is me signing off. Thank you.
Thank you, Ray.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by Center for Science and Culture.